Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll learn how one iconic Fresno restaurant is being forced out of its longtime home due to construction for high-speed rail, and why its owner is concerned he might even be forced to close temporarily if he can't find a new location before the demolition crews begin. We'll also get an update from Rebecca Plevin on what's being called an unprecedented meeting on Valley Fever that's taking place right now in Bakersfield with the heads of the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health. We'll hear how a new clinical trial might bring some hope for people suffering with the disease. That and a preview of the Fresno Philharmonic's 60th anniversary season with one of the brightest stars in classical music today, Israeli pianist Enon Barnaton. That's all coming up on today's Valley Edition, right after the news.
I'm Ezra David Romero with these news headlines. Tens of thousands of Californians are still facing delays in getting their unemployment checks because the state had problems with the installation of a new payment system. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento.
The state's Employment Development Department says it's working hard to clear the backlog, but it likely can't work fast enough for the roughly 80,000 Californians who were still waiting for their unemployment claims to be processed on Monday. The EDD's Lori Levy says the majority of approved applicants are still getting their checks on time.
It's just we have this backlog we've got to finish getting through so those poor individuals who we have really created some hardships for can be taken care of and then hopefully smooth the way for them moving forward.
Levy says EDD staff worked through the past weekend and will be working through the coming one as well in an effort to clear the backlog. She says she can't predict when everyone will be taken care of, but she says the department does anticipate making progress in the coming days. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
California drivers will soon be required to leave at least 3 feet between them and bicyclists they pass on the roads. Ben Adler has more from Sacramento on that and some of the other bills signed Monday by California Governor Jerry Brown.
Of the 15 bills the governor just signed, the passing distance bill could have the biggest effect on Californians' daily lives. Drivers who don't pass bicyclists by at least 3 feet will face a $30 fine. That penalty will rise to $220 if a driver's violation of the new law leads to an accident. The measure will take effect in mid-September of next year. Brown also signed a bill making it illegal to use computer programs that skip to the front of the digital line to buy sports or concert tickets on the web, and legislation allowing minors to remove their internet and social media posts. The governor vetoed a measure that would have added 2 seats to the 18-member California Commission on Emergency Medical Services. It's just the 6th bill he's vetoed this year, out of the nearly 350 he's already acted on. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Construction on the first portion of California's high-speed rail project is just months away, and that means some businesses along the route will soon be forced to find new homes. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports from downtown Fresno, some longtime business owners are worried about what the future holds and keeping their operations on track.
For most of the past century, the building that sits on the southwest corner of Fresno and G Streets in downtown Fresno has been passed down from generation to generation.
In 1933, when Prohibition was repealed, my father and an uncle came here and started the Cosmopolitan Tavern. Previous to that, it was a boarding house.
That was Gary Lanfranco, owner of the Cosmopolitan Bar and Grill. His father passed along the restaurant to him in 1968.
What are you having today, sir?
I'll try the Bronx Bomber, actually.
The eatery serves up everything from tri-tip sandwiches at lunch to Giovanni's gnocchi at dinner.
Your total is $13.58. Credit or debit?
Credit.
In 1998, Gary's son Joseph joined him in serving old-time Italian cuisine, hoping to carry on the family's legacy.
He's the fourth generation, and he's really the driving force behind it now. He's the reason that we're still in business, and he does a great job.
But the restaurant's fate now lies in the hands of someone outside the family, the California High Speed Rail Authority. The reason?
We're being replaced. We're being displaced, actually.
The Cosmopolitan lies in the path of a planned underpass along the impending high-speed rail corridor.
They're extending the Fresno Street underpass, and I believe the infrastructure of the underpass will be taking a portion of the front of our building. And it's supposed to be a big project, and it's supposed to be coming soon.
The rail system's first phase, a 29-mile segment from Madera to downtown Fresno, is scheduled for completion by 2018. The cost? Just under $1 billion. Construction was supposed to begin this fall, but is now expected to begin in 2014. But that's not stopping the High Speed Rail Authority from moving forward. In April, the authority sent out 150 offers to businesses along the first stretch, ranging from mom-and-pop restaurants to large-scale manufacturers. A total of 51 offers have been agreed upon. The Cosmopolitan was one of many businesses offered a buyout.
I've received an offer, and I haven't settled on it yet. It isn't really enough for me to replace what I have.
Not enough money is exactly why Valprint, a 60-year-old print and design firm located one block north of the Cosmopolitan, has hired a Fresno-based appraiser. They, too, are trying to fight for a better deal than was initially offered by the High Speed Rail Authority.
Ideally, we would like to have to be able to consolidate our operation into one building, you know, which would mean they would have to acquire our existing building here, too. And that's under consideration right now because relocating our distribution center, you know, maybe a mile, two, three, 4 miles away is going to be it's going to incur more costs and it's going to be not as quite as efficient.
That was Jack Amirian, the owner of Valprint. He says the bullet train will knock out the company's warehouse and two of his rental properties. He says the rail authority offered him $430,000 for the warehouse, but the building is worth more than $700,000. Amirian, who supports High Speed Rail, says his biggest concern about the process is that he might have to go into debt to reestablish his business.
Our issue is really to try to find comparable properties that we can either acquire or build, and we're way off on the price to do that because we don't feel that we should have to incur additional debt to replace those properties.
The Rail Authority is negotiating with Amirian to work on a comparable deal. Diana Gomez, the Central Valley Regional Director for High Speed Rail, says that offers and negotiations with businesses and property owners along the first leg of construction are going well.
Our goal is to try to work with everybody as early as possible so then they can be relocated, you know, somewhere within the city and maybe not lose any downtime.
Gomez says the High Speed Rail Authority has every intention to work with those impacted by the bullet train.
Our goal is to minimize, you know, the impacts and assure them that, you know, we want to do what's right, you know, by every single property owner that's impacted.
She also says the Economic Development Corporation for Fresno County has been a partner in finding new homes for those in the region being relocated.
That's one of the reasons that we got involved, is to ensure that those businesses have an advocate that can help them through that process.
That was Leanne Eager, president and CEO of the EDC, whose goal is to retain business in Fresno County. She says the group is working with every business along the corridor to not only find new locations, but to make sure negotiations with the Rail Authority are fair.
We contacted the High Speed Rail Authority and the City of Fresno and the County of Fresno and said, you know, let's look at working together to make sure that we keep our businesses here.
Back at the Cosmopolitan, Gary Lanfranco and son are facing an uncertain future.
Our soup of the day is clam chowder today.
With construction looming, not only is he looking for a new building, he's on the clock to find one soon, so he isn't forced to close even temporarily.
I'm afraid by being closed for a period of time until I can reopen someplace, I'm going to lose some really good help. And that's difficult. All these things are very, very difficult. The high-speed rail people, I just don't think they understand the situation for some people, you know, especially with a history like we have. We're doing well in an area that we're not supposed to be doing well in.
He fears that his customers may not come back. Not because of a lack of loyalty, but rather lack of parking.
Well, I need a building approximately the size that I have, 5,000 square feet. I need a parking lot that'll park approximately 40 cars, and I need no debt. That's exactly what I have now.
But despite all Lanfranco's fears about the coming change, he says he's not going to fight the bullet train.
I'm a big boy. I'm resigned to the fact. I'm willing to make it work as long as the state helps me make it work. I'm not out to make any money off this thing. I just want to stay whole.
Lanfranco says he hopes to know more about the Cosmopolitan's new location in the coming months. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And you're listening to Valley Edition. Joining us now in the studio, we have Tim Sheehan from the Fresno Bee. He's the reporter who's been following the high-speed rail project really since its inception and has been doing great work on covering all of the myriad angles of this story as it goes through the courts and the environmental review process and the construction process, which is now looming. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Tim, what's going on with the construction deadlines with this project? Back in 2010 and 2011, all accounts from the media, all accounts from the High Speed Rail Authority said that construction absolutely had to begin in October 2012, citing the Federal Stimulus Act. Then all of a sudden, that deadline became a soft deadline and was pushed back to 2013. And now we're hearing 2014. What's going on with these deadlines?
I wish I had a great answer for that, but I don't. I think what we're seeing is a consistent inconsistency. As you pointed out, these deadlines have slipped, and the only hard and fast deadline that is really out there is September 2017, and that's when the federal money that's been allocated, some $3 billion for the entire valley stretch from Madera down toward Bakersfield, has to be spent, matched with state funds. So the authority has said that they still believe they can make substantially that September 2017 deadline if they get started in 2014 with their construction. One of the things that they've pointed out is since they awarded the contract for the design and construction is that it has to be designed before it can be constructed. So that is the work that Tudor Perini, Zachary, and Parsons, the consortium that was awarded the contract earlier this year, they're now hopefully knee-deep in their design and engineering of this project so that when they do start turning shovels, they'll be able to do it fairly quickly. We don't know exactly how that's going, but they are opening their office. They've got an office in Fresno now in downtown where they're installing their engineers and their designers to begin work on this project.
Definitely an interesting drama. Speaking of drama, there's a courtroom drama that involves a Sacramento judge, Michael Kenney. He has two lawsuits before him involving this project. Mm-hmm. He's already ruled on one case brought by some Valley farmers saying that the blended approach that high-speed rail is taking doesn't meet the requirements that voters approved back in 2008. Tell us about these court cases.
Right. That lawsuit, which was filed by Kings County and two of its residents, essentially asserts a couple of different things. And one of those is that the project as it's proposed now isn't what was promised to voters. The second part is a little more technical, and that's the part that the judge has partially ruled on. And that was that the requirements of Proposition 1A required not only that the authority identify all of the funding needed for an initial operating segment, which right now is considered Merced to Los Angeles, but also that all of the environmental clearances for that initial operating segment be completed before construction begins. As you're aware, and as a lot of your listeners are aware, the only environmental clearance that's been approved so far by the Rail Authority is Merced to Fresno. Fresno to Bakersfield is still pending. Bakersfield to Palmdale is still pending. Palmdale to the Los Angeles Basin is still pending.
And even part of the Merced to Fresno section is still up in the air around Chowchilla, right?
The chunk around Chowchilla where there's going to be a Y-shaped junction that connects the Merced-Fresno line with the line that goes west towards San Jose, that is still pending, right. They're still waiting to see what they're going to come up with there as a final route.
So the judge in Sacramento has said initially that it's not portions of what they're doing aren't in compliance with Prop 1A, but he hasn't ordered them to stop work.
Exactly. What he said is he's asking the attorneys for the high-speed rail opponents and the high-speed rail authority to submit arguments on what they think should be done to remedy the situation. The judge has presumably a range of options at his disposal, and he'll be deciding that in November. There's another case coming up where the High Speed Rail Authority is the plaintiff. They are suing, I guess, everybody in the state who thinks that maybe these bonds that were approved by Proposition 1A in 2008 shouldn't be issued at all. And so that's called a bond validation case, and that is going to be decided or it's going to be argued Friday in Sacramento.
So some news will be forthcoming on the legal aspects of this case.
Yes.
There's another interesting thing that popped up back in late August. The High Speed Rail Authority and Attorney General Kamala Harris did something rather unusual. They basically said that the state's landmark environmental law, the California Environmental Quality Act, it doesn't apply to high-speed rail any longer. Walk us through that and what that really means for this project with the whole thing about federal oversight and state oversight and whose laws are the toughest or weakest.
Well, generally, the state law is considered tougher than the federal law. The National Environmental Policy Act Environmental Policy Act is the law that that the Federal Surface Transportation Board would use to evaluate this. And the Surface Transportation Board has to weigh in on most rail projects in the country. It's interesting because the High-Speed Rail Authority initially earlier this year said, we don't think we fall under the auspices of the Surface Transportation Board. The Surface Transportation Board disagreed and said, nope, we're going to exercise jurisdiction over this. So when the Surface Transportation Board decided to take that position, that kind of cast a little bit of doubt on whether federal law or state environmental law would apply. That issue is now before a state appeals court, and so that is pending also. There's a lot. There's a lot that's pending and a lot to still be decided. Yet, as all those decisions are waiting to be made, the authority is still, you know, trying to forge ahead with this.
There's also a political aspect in Washington to this as well, as folks such as Congressman Valadao and others are working to stop any additional funding for high-speed rail moving forward.
Right.
I hear a concern from some people in the Valley saying, I'm worried, or they're worried that we build this initial stretch from Madera to Fresno, we disrupt all these lives in this area, these businesses, and then nothing else is built. And that's what some folks are pushing for, because in it, that section from Madera to Fresno isn't all that usable beyond its as just a stub.
Absolutely. I mean, the money that they have in hand, the money that the Rail Authority has in hand, they believe can get them from Madera to just north of Bakersfield. And they have argued that they have, if they never receive any additional money from the feds or anywhere else for this project, that stretch of tracks would be usable by Amtrak for dedicated service to get Amtrak off of the freight rails. Is that enough bang for the buck for $6 billion? Who knows? That's up for each person to decide. The opponents, Congressman Valadao, Congressman Nunez, Congressman McCarthy, they would all say, no, it's not. And the proponents would say, yeah, but we think we're going to get more money. Congress can come and Congresses can go. And we have a Congress right now that says no, but you know, that's not necessarily always going to be the case. So there's definitely doubt over what's happening now and doubt over what may happen in the future.
Reporter Tim Sheehan from the Fresno Bee joins us on Valley Edition right now. We're talking about high-speed rail, the latest on this ongoing saga. I'm sure there will be many more twists and turns in this story. Once construction actually does begin, assuming the legal challenges are overcome and the High-Speed Rail Authority moves forward, construction begins in 2014. What's going to be the most visible part of this? Is it the Highway 99, moving Highway 99 over several hundred feet?
I think
what will people see?
That's probably going to be the biggie. That's probably going to be the most disruptive piece of this is what's going to happen to 99 while Caltrans is shoving it over by 100 feet between Clinton and Ashland Avenues here through central Fresno. But there's going to be a lot going on. You don't build something like this without breaking a few eggs, I guess. There's going to be a number of overpasses that are going to have to be built that would span not only the high-speed rail tracks but the existing freight tracks. Because you can't have at-grade crossings. There's not going to be any crossing arms coming down to block traffic because we see too often people going around those gates and getting hit by a train. At the types of speeds that they're talking about with these trains, you can't have that. There's also going to be a new major bridge over the San Joaquin River for the train. And also at the south end of Fresno, there is planned an aerial viaduct that will carry these high-speed trains as they head south out of Fresno down toward Hanford to not only cross – it'll essentially cross over Highway 99 as it heads south to follow roughly the Burlington Northern tracks that Amtrak uses now. So there's going to be some major structures out there that people will see, along with some of the not so major structures like road overpasses and crossings over ditches and things like that.
One last thing before we go, Tim. A few years ago, all the buzz about the heavy maintenance facility, all these communities in the valley were trying to secure the heavy maintenance facility. Mm-hmm. Is there any news on that? Where does that stand? Does one community have the leg up on the other?
Not yet. A lot of the Madera County sites are maybe out of play because the routes that are being talked about in that area aren't really adjacent to a lot of those particular sites. I think probably the front runners remain Fresno and the site just south of Fresno and some sites in Kern County that were proposed. But no decision yet.
Yeah, very interesting, and I'm sure this case will continue to take some interesting turns.
I'm counting on it.
Exactly. Again, Tim Sheehan from the Fresno Bee joining us today to talk about high-speed rail. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and find out about that big, unprecedented meeting with the heads of the CDC and NIH in Bakersfield about Valley Fever. That's coming up in just a moment. We'll learn about a new clinical trial that was announced last night and what hope it might bring for those who are suffering with the disease. That's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition, Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Yesterday, at a symposium on Valley Fever in Bakersfield, the leaders of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health announced a new clinical trial that could finally provide some answers about this chronically overlooked disease. Our FM 89 reporter, Rebecca Plevin, brings us this report.
Today, doctors don't agree on how important it is to diagnose and treat Valley Fever right away when a patient has pneumonia. They don't know if early treatment can shorten the disease or prevent it from becoming more serious.
There's so many things we don't know about Valley Fever, and the best way to get the answers is to run a clinical trial.
That's National Institutes of Health Director Dr. Francis Collins. He announced the trial yesterday at the start of a two-day meeting on Valley Fever, hosted by Bakersfield Congressman Kevin McCarthy. Collins said about 1,000 people from the region will need to participate in the trial. It will track patients and their health outcomes to determine which treatments work best. It's expected to cost millions of dollars.
And even though right now funding for medical research is in a pretty tight place, this seems like a priority and we should just do it.
The trial will also help doctors and experts determine which diagnostic tests are most reliable. Ann Collins says it should help raise awareness of Valley Fever, which is chronically misdiagnosed.
You don't necessarily think of it. Even in a place like Bakersfield, where this is a common disease, people oftentimes still think of some other kind of pneumonia before they have the light bulb go on and think, oh, Valley Fever, why didn't I think of that?
The announcement was made to the public on Monday evening during a forum on the disease at the Kern County Health Department. About 200 people attended the event, and many shared their experiences with the disease and asked questions about it. Afterwards, CDC Director Dr. Thomas Frieden said hearing patients' stories underscored the need for the trial.
To hear the individual stories and the challenges that people face just reinforces how important it is that we understand it better, that we understand how to diagnose it better, how to treat it better, and how to prevent it better.
Lisa Limbeck of Rosemont attended the meeting and was excited to hear about the trial. The 26-year-old has Valley Fever meningitis, and the fungus has settled in her brain.
It's about time somebody opened their eyes. We've been dealing with this for quite some time. I'm glad somebody's finally saying it's important enough to be acknowledged.
The forum continues today at CSU Bakersfield. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And Rebecca joins us now in our studio back from the conference that began last night at the Kern County Health Department. It continues this afternoon and today at CSU Bakersfield. Rebecca, what was the overall mood at the event last night?
So, as you mentioned, the meeting was held at the Kern County Health Department, and when I got there, it was standing room only. It was packed with people, and I think a lot of them were survivors. A lot of them had just very, very intense stories to share about their experiences with Valley Fever, their frustrations. People had lots of questions about the best way to treat the disease, and so it was really clear that with this disease, there are so many more questions than answers, and
I think they conveyed that to the directors of the CDC and the NIH, who were very receptive.
It's very interesting. I go back to almost a year ago, both of us were at a similar town hall event that was held also at the Kern County Health Department by then Senator Michael Rubio. Thinking about that event and how far it's come, having the heads of the two leading health organizations in the country for the federal government, the CDC and the NIH, in the same room, has there been significant progress made in that sense in getting attention for this long-forgotten disease?
I'd say so. Yeah, both of us attended that meeting about a year ago, and it was really important to get the word out about Valley Fever, and I think it was well attended. But this one, it was as if people finally had come out of the woodwork and are ready to share their stories and share their experiences and come together to say, this is a problem here in the Valley, and let's find some solutions, let's find some answers.
I think one of the things that a lot of people who are involved in this disease or battling Valley Fever, they always talk about, we need to get the attention of people beyond the Valley. We need to raise the profile of this disease. But it seems like there hasn't really been that effort to hasn't coalesced to bring those forces together. What about the grassroots movement? Are we going to see that finally develop? I know that there's talk of forming a support group. It seems like that's something that could have been done a long time ago. Where are we in terms of the overall community in Kern County, Tulare County, Fresno County, throughout the state, even Arizona, trying to get together and say this is an important thing because there are people dying here because of this disease?
Right. So I wrote a story that ran in several newspapers this weekend on this topic of grassroots movements, maybe what the Valley Fever movement can learn. And I think we find that there are online support groups for Valley Fever. And there's an organization in Bakersfield that raises money for research and tries to get the word out. I would hope that as with this meeting here, with all this attention shined on the disease, that there will be a group that can come together and sort of carry on that momentum and push for change with this disease.
Well, I guess this brings up the question of how do folks with different diseases organize and bring greater attention to their efforts and some of those challenges. And I understand you have some more to tell us about that.
That's right, Joe. So earlier this year, I had the chance to speak with Baron Lerner. He's a medical professor at NYU, and he's written several books about patient lobbies and patient movements. And I asked him what people in the Valley Fever movement can learn from these other disease movements. What have you seen that has made a patient lobby or patient advocacy group successful?
Well, it takes a lot of legwork and a lot of energy. A lot of groups are interested in publicizing their particular disease, so there's a lot of competition out there. What successful groups have done is what I would call a grassroots sort of campaign. So they try to get as many people interested in the issue as possible. A lot of the people have either had the disease or know someone who's had the disease. And they start doing a lot of different activities. One is publicity. They do lobbying. So they go to their local legislatures and try to get attention paid by legislators and funding for the disease. They go to local public health officials and say, this is a disease that's been overlooked or neglected, and you need to focus your energies not only in other diseases, but this one as well. So it tends to be a mixture of grassroots type activities.
Are there examples you've seen in your research where this was really successful?
Yeah, there's a lot of very successful groups. I think two that people know very well would be AIDS and breast cancer. Now, they obviously start with an advantage in the sense that there were a lot of people with both of those diseases, and it's a nationwide disease, and they're both pretty devastating diseases. So they had a lot to build on. But even in those cases, they had to overcome some early ignorance. So people didn't understand the disease as well as they could. They had to overcome some stigma. So certainly people with AIDS and even breast cancer, although it's hard to believe from our modern perspective, felt shy, ashamed of their disease, unwilling to come out with it publicly. That's obviously changed. So they had to confront that. But once they were able to surmount those barriers, they have been really successful at putting the word out there. So you think of ribbons. So the breast cancer people have the pink ribbon. The AIDS people have the Red Ribbon. They've been very successful at recruiting celebrities to help publicize these particular diseases because people are very interested in this country in celebrity. And so that's another way often that a disease can go from pretty much invisible to much more visible really overnight.
You have a recent book about that, right? About how celebrities can help raise the profile of the disease?
Yes. I wrote a book basically about celebrity patients, and that's one of the things they do. They elevate interest in a disease partly because of their medical condition, right? So if these people either have the disease or they know a friend or family member and they want to talk about it publicly, they obviously have a very good forum to do so. I think that the public and the media is eager to talk to celebrities who are willing to go public with their diagnosis or with information about a particular disease. You might think of someone like Michael J. Fox as a great example. I mean, how can you not admire him, right? So he's got a very difficult disease, Parkinson's. He's willing to talk openly about his diagnosis, about his treatments, even his prognosis. That puts a lot of energy behind a campaign to publicize the disease. The fact is that celebrities hold a lot of oomph in this country, and sometimes that can be marshaled in an important cause, for example, publicizing a given disease.
I know that there was a really prominent Valley Fever researcher who recently died. I've heard anecdotally that he used to say that he wished someone who was mildly famous would get a very mild case of Valley Fever, you know, just so that they would be able to shine a more, you know, broader light on the disease. And I, you know, it's interesting. I know that there are some baseball players who have gotten it, but I don't think they've been willing to really, you know, talk about it openly.
You know, I think I've heard that so commonly, not just with respect to Valley Fever, but other diseases. People have come up to me, for example, after I've spoken about breast cancer publicly and said, we're like the lung cancer people and we can't find a celebrity to talk about lung cancer. Unfortunately, so many of them die, but it's a very common problem that you want someone who's a spokesperson and someone who people will admire to get out there. But it's hard to do because these are illnesses, they're private things, and just because some people are willing to go public about certain diseases doesn't mean that someone with something like Valley Fever will also feel the need to do that.
I interviewed a man who has AIDS and, you know, has been involved in the AIDS movement since it began decades ago. And he was talking about the need for, just in general, a champion. The champion for them became Ryan White because he was someone who, at that point, the disease was stigmatized as a gay disease. And they were able to, you know, it was unfortunate that a child had to get it for them to be able to find a champion, but that was who was able to put that public face on it. And so going beyond celebrities, that's something that you've seen, that there just needs to be some sort of champion that can really put a face on the diseases?
Absolutely. It doesn't have to necessarily be a famous person. To begin with, it has to be someone who grabs the public's attention. So exactly. Ryan White was not a famous person until he got sick. And you can find many other diseases where someone, an ordinary person, got the disease, but their story was so compelling and the people working with them were so good at getting that story out to the public that they do become visible faces of the disease and you get people to pay attention. And mind you, it's very helpful to get not just people with that disease, but you want to expand it to the broader population. Another challenge for something like Valley Fever, ironically, is the name. I think if people hear fever, they may say, oh, all right, well, so people get a fever, they hear valley, they don't live near a valley. Why should I be concerned about this? And the reality is that's where the salesmanship needs to come in. And certainly the numbers of people who are getting sick with this disease in California are very significant and there are deaths from it. So the challenge then is to say, gee, it's called Valley Fever. It may not sound so severe to you, but it can really not only be severe but misdiagnosed. And I think that is potentially a compelling argument for people to say, you know what, this is something you could get and you really should know about it just in case your doctor doesn't figure it out.
It's almost like you need a rebranding because the name sounds so benign.
Well, there's some interesting stories. It's hard to rebrand, but for example, people with chronic fatigue syndrome have been upset over the years that their disease is called a syndrome, right? So they said, well, gee, if you call something a syndrome, people aren't going to take it seriously enough. We feel like we have a disease and we need to get more concern about this. That's one example. I mean, that hasn't been resolved in any way. So many groups have been through this issue of trying to find names that grab the public's attention that are more legitimate. You know, when we learned about it in medical school, it was always called coccidiomycosis. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the way, somebody changed the name, I guess, or it was called both. But it was interesting to me that when I learned it, it was coccidiomycosis.
Yeah.
No one ever said valley fever. This was 30 years ago, obviously.
You still hear medical people calling it that,
yes,
or calling it cocci.
Right. Cocci, yeah. I mean, you know, coccidiomycosis, it's obviously doesn't trip off the tongue, but it does sound more ominous than valley fever,
right,
I must say.
What other lessons can we take from other movements, maybe apply them to this disease to help, you know, raise the profile of it?
Well, another thing that's been very helpful for these diseases is to get people involved who are very outgoing and won't take no for an answer. So I will tell you, if you look back at the history of activism for not just diseases, another topic I've researched is drunk driving. That was something that people ignored for years that then became a very important topic. The people who start these campaigns and movements have to be so committed to it that they really devote an enormous amount of energy to it, because otherwise it gets subsumed by other worthy causes. So, I mean, I think we would love to live in a world where the diseases that cause the most harm would get the most funding and the diseases that weren't so important would get less funding. But the fact of the matter is, the reality is, the groups that scream loudest and have the best stories often get the most resources. And you get someone probably who's had the disease or knows someone with the disease and maybe has some connections who really will not only try to engineer a public relations campaign, but stick with it and be very determined.
That was my conversation with NYU medical professor Baron Lerner about how to build a grassroots patient movement around valley fever.
Well, Rebecca, thank you very much for the reporting on this story. And again, the conference continues at CSU Bakersfield this afternoon. Rebecca, thanks.
Thank you, Joe.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about a new film that is premiering in Fresno at Chuck Chancey Park about hunger. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. According to the USDA, 50 million Americans live in a household that has experienced food insecurity. The number is even higher for children. 1 in 4 kids in the U.S. struggled with hunger at some point in 2012. Those are staggering numbers, especially in a country that is so rich and produces so much food. A new documentary film seeks to find some answers to why this is such a big issue. It's called A Place at the Table, and it tells the stories of those who struggle just to eat. The film will make its Fresno premiere Saturday night at an, well, rather unusual venue, downtown Fresno's Chuck Chancey Park Baseball Stadium. We're joined now on Valley Edition by Tom Matat of Fresno Metro Ministries Community Garden Program, who is partnering with the Fresno Grizzlies Community Fund to bring the film to the Central Valley. Tom, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
And we're also joined on the phone by filmmaker Christy Jacobson. Christy, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The paradox of having so much hunger affecting so many people in such a wealthy food-producing nation is so shocking. You tell this story through the stories of three families, three people who are dealing with food insecurity. Tell us about your film and how it came about.
Well, I think, you know, as you said, it's a shocking paradox to discover is happening right here in this country. And it was something we wanted to explore as filmmakers. For me, you know, I think many people are most aware that there's hunger in their communities or in this country around the holidays when the campaigns, the food drive campaigns are everywhere. But we learn a little bit about the hungry in our communities, but I think that rarely, are we asking the question of why we have so much hunger here in this country? And that was our mission, was to look at why and share with audiences some of the incredibly powerful stories of the working families, working moms, kids, all across this country who experience hunger on a daily basis, and it really puts those individuals in a tough place and at a disadvantage, and as a nation, it's really setting us back.
Your team is certainly no stranger to documentaries and documentaries about food with prior production that you're behind with Food, Inc. The film premiered at Sundance in 2012 and now is in distribution this year. What's the response been like from the folks who have seen this movie so far?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. First of all, we're really excited about the event happening on Saturday because it's just the type of screening and environment and venue you hope for when you make a film like this. And I think, you know, across the board, the response has been, it's time to change the conversation around this issue. It's time to look deeply at ourselves, at our nation, and really get together on working towards solutions because this is a solvable problem. And I've found that people, once they're aware of it, once you're a witness to it from having seen the film, there's incredible outrage and enthusiasm for tackling this problem and putting some pressure where it needs to be placed, which is on politicians.
Is there a certain shame involving this issue that maybe keeps it in the shadows in some way, that the people don't want to talk about being food insecure or don't want to, you know, recognize that it's such an issue?
There is. And I think, you know, one of many of the challenges of making this film is that the problem itself is invisible. Or even represents itself in ways that make people think, well, that person's obese, they must not be hungry. So you can't see it in the average person who's experiencing hunger here. But then on top of that, it has, you know, over the past many decades, become an issue for which people are blamed. So there's a lot of shame associated with it. And we spent a lot of time talking to a lot of people who didn't necessarily want to go on camera, but really helped to educate us about that. And then, of course, we were fortunate to film with some incredibly courageous people who shared that their vulnerability and with the hope that people start to perceive the problem differently, and those who are struggling to put food on the table less as people for whom we should place blame and more as people for whom we should feel one with and together and looking to remove that sense of shame.
Turning now to Tom Matat from Fresno Metro Ministries Community Garden Program, who joins us now in the studio. Tom, what does your organization hope to do by partnering with the Grizzlies Community Fund and bringing this documentary to Fresno?
Well, we really wanted to raise awareness. You know, being here in Fresno in the middle of this incredible food-producing place, a lot of people just don't understand the degree of hunger that we actually have. And the Food Research Action Center does a survey every year and focusing on food insecurity. And for 2012, Fresno was ranked the fifth most food insecure city in the United States. And that means that folks just don't have a consistent way of accessing food on a regular basis. So we've got 22.5% of our population, which is about 125,000 people, that can't get food on the table nearly 20% of the time. So if you have to pick which week out of the month you're not going to eat, that's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. So we want to raise awareness.
So tell us a little more about what's going to be going on at the stadium. It's not just a film screening, as I understand.
Yeah, it's not just a film screening. We kind of wanted to make this to raise awareness for all the different folks that are actually working on this issue here in town. So we've got some food trucks that are going to be out there. Casa de Tamales will be out. These folks are showing up in random places all over town and selling food directly. We're going to have a little farmer's market out there, hoping for people to understand that food is cheaper at farmer's markets. And those things can pop up anywhere. Partnering with the Grizzlies Community Fund has been really excellent. We've got the Community Food Bank coming out, Youth Leadership Institute, Vineyard Farmers Market, different folks like that are just doing a lot of work in the access world.
Now, Tom, you're involved in solutions to this issue,
right.
And obviously food banks and those things play huge roles, but you're very focused on, in this agricultural region, teaching mm-hmm. people to grow their own food, and that being an interesting way to solve this. Tell us more about how community gardens and backyard gardening can maybe address this for folks.
Yeah, well, being able to grow your own food, you know, we're really blessed to be in such a place that we can do this kind of stuff. We've got incredible weather for it. We've got lots of space. And these kinds of things, you know, anybody who's ever grown a garden knows that you can't almost eat all the food you grow in it. And so trying to develop networks of folks that are growing food in neighborhoods can really address this. And, you know, just giving food to your neighbor that maybe you're not going to get to eat, whether or not you know they're hungry, is a positive impact on that local food supply.
And turning back to Christy now, in some ways this issue has become politicized. Last week we saw a bill passed by the House that would cut $4 billion a year for the food stamp program over the next 10 years. Republicans say it's a necessary reform to curb abuse of the program. There's these videos floating about of this guy who's buying lobster with food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
Is that more of a myth and more of the exception to the rule? And what are your views on how this issue plays in Washington and also plays with voters overall?
Well, I think that you're exactly right. This one video about this one example is the story that seems to capture the nation's attention. And, you know, the food stamp program is one of the most efficient government-run programs of all the programs. It has a very, very, very low rate of fraud. So, you know, majority of the people collecting food stamps are working, have at least one working parent or adult in the home. I think that the real facts about food stamps tend to get lost amidst the sensational, you know, the sensational stories that you know, those that want to cut the program seem to promote. And it's a real shame, because the truth is that there are 50 million Americans who are approximately, you know, rely on this program to put food on the table. The program is Most people are on the program for a very short period of time to help them get through tough times. We have, as part of our film's outreach, we have a website where it's called SNAP Alumni, and you can see a whole host of examples. These are the stories that need to be out there and get circulated, of people who's as a child relied on food stamps, and now, for example, a young woman who runs a food bank organization in Northern California, a lawyer in Philadelphia who used the program when she was young and had a child and wanted to get through school. So these are the stories we should be talking about, and I encourage people to look at the sources of the information that they're getting and try and find the truth.
We've been talking with filmmaker Christy Jacobson. She is the voice behind the new film, the filmmaker behind the new film called A Place at the Table. It makes its Fresno premiere at Chuck Chancey Park, the downtown baseball stadium, Saturday night at 5 p.m. in a special screening presented by the Fresno Grizzlies Community Fund and Fresno Metro Ministry. Tom Matat also joins us today. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Christy, thank you as well. Looking forward to the screening.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. We'll be right back. Fifty years ago, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered an address that would issue reverberating calls for racial equality. In this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Communication Professor Diane Blair says that while we've made great progress, our awareness of lingering inequalities is essential to creating a more just tomorrow.
The 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech lends itself to both commemoration and reflection. How far have we come, and what work still needs to be done? Having the first African-American president commemorate the march at the very place King delivered his address speaks volumes about the racial barriers that have been broken. Laws have been passed banning racial discrimination in public accommodations and housing. African-Americans now vote in percentages similar to whites. And education levels for blacks have increased significantly since the 1960s. While we certainly no longer tolerate Jim Crow laws in the nation, racial inequalities do persist. The net worth of the median white family is still more than six times that of blacks. Unemployment and poverty rates for blacks are persistently twice that of whites. Black children born into poverty are less likely to rise up the income ladder. The incarceration rate for African Americans is six times higher than the national average. African Americans also have a lower average lifespan by about 5 years. If we are to keep the dream alive, we clearly need to acknowledge that disparities persist. However, that may be easier said than done. Polls show that most black people still feel they are treated less fairly by the police, the courts, at work, and in schools. Yet few whites agree, and some express weariness over continued discussions of the role of race in America. For example, a 2011 Greenlining Institute study, which examined 3 years of survey data, revealed that black and white Americans are still miles apart regarding their perceptions of racial inequality. When asked how much discrimination currently exists in America, more than 56% of black respondents said there was a lot. Among Latinos, 27% gave that answer. Only 16% of white respondents said they thought a lot of discrimination existed in today's society. The majority of white respondents also indicated that persistent inequalities were more a matter of people not trying hard enough. If blacks would only try harder, they could be just as well off as whites. Such disparate perceptions are primarily the result of personal or vicarious experiences. Absent contact with everyday black communities, it's easier for whites to hold an overly positive view of race relations. But if we're unwilling to acknowledge that disparities still exist, it makes it much more difficult to tackle them. Ultimately, King's speech was a call for the races to recognize that our destiny and our freedom as a nation are inextricably bound together. If we measure racial equality comparing the present to the past, America has made great strides. However, if we evaluate racial equality in comparison to King's dream, we still have a ways to go. For The Moral Is, I'm Diane Blair.
Listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We're listening to music by pianist Enon Barnaton. It's his new CD featuring two piano sonatas by Franz Schubert. He'll be making an appearance in Fresno this weekend, but not playing Schubert, instead Tchaikovsky, in a concert that begins the 60th anniversary season for the Fresno Philharmonic in a new location, performing this time at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall at Clovis North High School in North Fresno. Enon Barnaton joins us now on the telephone. Enon, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's a great pleasure to have you with us today on our program. Tell us a little more about how you became involved in the world of classical music as a young child growing up in Israel.
Well, I was too young to remember this, but the story in my family goes that there was a piano in the house that my mother played when she was much younger, and she would every once in a while play something, and apparently at one point as a very young child, maybe 3 years old, I started correcting her from the other room, which I guess is a little obnoxious, but I was too young to be obnoxious. And through that experience, they found out that I have perfect pitch and that I was very drawn to the piano and always tried to pick out tunes and songs. So they sent me to my first piano lesson. Even though my parents were not musicians, it was very obvious that I wanted to be involved with that instrument and wanted to make sounds. That's the story, at least the way that my mother tells it. So,
that's a great story. And then was there ever a point that you thought about going in another direction later on in life, teenagers and all the various things that teens are involved with? Your friends, I imagine, were doing other things other than practicing the piano.
Well, not really. Playing the piano for me was always something very natural and very fun. I never viewed it as a chore. And, of course, it wasn't always easy to practice when your friends are playing outside. But I've always loved playing, so it was never a matter of whether I was going to do it as a career. The idea of it being a career was a much later one. It was just something that I wanted to do, and I wanted to do a lot of. And I think as a child, I played more than I practiced, which perhaps is not the most efficient way of doing things, but it does give one, and certainly gave me, the idea that playing music is fun. And that helped in growing up, that I didn't feel that it was a chore or something that I should get away from, but rather the opposite.
That's fascinating. Do you think that's a potential thing that maybe sometimes in music education is left out, that emphasis on playing the piano, the word there is play, and to encourage that exploration and fun with the instrument?
Absolutely. I think that should be part of the way that people learn an instrument, is that as much as we want to have things done the right way, which they should be, but we should never forget that playing music is a fantastic, wonderful thing, not a chore that one has to go through like folding laundry. So for a child, I think, to feel that and really want to do it is as important as doing it.
This new CD, which we just heard a selection from, is literally brand new. It came out just a few days ago. Tell me a little more about the recording process, going into the studio and recording a work or a concert hall without an audience, without that immediacy of being in the moment. How does that differ from being in front of a packed concert hall across the globe, whether it's in Fresno at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall or at the Concertgebouw or at Lincoln Center?
It's a very different experience, and it's very difficult experience. I find it very traumatic almost, although it gets more and more familiar with every recording that you make, and then therefore a little bit easier with every recording that you make. But I think some people like Glenn Gould really preferred recording that to live performances, and I'm exactly the opposite. It's the energy of an audience and the attentiveness and level of listening of an audience really brings, I think, a performance to life, and just the electricity in a hall is something that really fuels a performance, both, I think, for a performer and for the audience. So to try and create that or recreate that in a recording studio is very difficult. On the other hand, you do get to play on the piano of your choice, in the acoustic of your choice, in ideal conditions, and you get many chances to do what you want to do. I mean, you don't have to worry so much about getting all the notes right, because you know you'll have another choice. So there's a freedom in that too. I think of it a little bit as like making a movie as opposed to appearing in a play.
Tell me a little more about the piece you'll be performing in Fresno, Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 2. What immediately comes to mind when you think of this work?
Well, several things. One of them is the fact that it's so wonderful to be able to play a piece by a famous composer and a very loved composer that very few people know. Everybody knows the first concerto, but very few people know the second concerto. And it's such a wonderful piece. Maybe my favorite part of it is the second movement, which actually is a triple concerto, because there's huge solo parts for the violin and cello leaders of the section. So the concertmaster, the first violinist, and the leader of the cello section, together with the piano, play almost a triple concerto, which is very special and very unusual. And I wonder whether that's one of the reasons that this concerto isn't played that very often, because maybe some pianists don't want to share the stage. But I'm very happy to do that in the second movement, especially also since the first and last movements are so virtuosic and demanding that It's also nice to get a little bit of a rest.
Yes, indeed. Again, our guest today is pianist Enon Barnaton. He is performing with the Fresno Philharmonic to open their 60th anniversary season in a concert that's an all Tchaikovsky bill, September 27th, 28th, and 29th at a new location for the orchestra, the Paul Chagoyan Memorial Concert Hall, a beautiful new facility with superb acoustics on the campus of Clovis North High School. Again, Friday night at 7:30, Saturday evening at 7:30 as well, and then the Sunday afternoon performance at 2:30 at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall. Enon Barnaton is our guest today on Valley Public Radio. Enon, thank you so much for joining us. We're looking forward to your performance.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to it too.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter @kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition reporter Rebecca Plevin, and Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.